Well, there was a when I was a kid, my dad used to take me to the barber shop. Now, I don't know if some of you even know what that word is, barber shop. But it's a place where we went to go get haircuts. And my dad, I remember still going there and sitting there. And back during those days, you could not only get a haircut, but you could get a shave. And I still remember this little jingle. Shave and a haircut, 2 bits, 25 cents. Get a shave and a haircut for 25 cents. Well, there was a guy that was a new Christian. He was a barber. And he was so excited about his faith. But when it came time to sharing his faith, he was just petrified to do this. He was just so, how am I going to do this? You're just so scared. So he went to a class on a Friday night at church on how to share his faith. And the part that he realized he should probably start is how to have or how to initiate a spiritual conversation. Kind of that first step. So he was all ears during that time, and the guy that was doing the instructing gave him some great questions to ask and some statements to make and some things that resonated with his story, and he got it. Okay, I think I can go do this. But he went home, and all day Saturday, he was thinking about, oh, but he's so afraid, and how do I do this? And he's trying to memorize his questions and his statements, and all day Sunday, the same thing. And Sunday night, he was just so sick of all this fear, he just said, I just need to make a commitment. I'm going to start a spiritual conversation with the first person that comes into my barbershop on Monday. So Monday came, and an older man came in, and the guy wanted a shave and a haircut. And so he sat down in the chair, and the barber put the drape around him and the thing around his neck, you know, to tighten up the drape. And then fear came upon him again. And he was just thinking, how am I going to do this? And he's trying to remember the questions that he had memorized. And he finally thought of one question. And then he started into to give the fellow to give the shave. And so he took out his shaving cream. And he just started shaking so much. Then when he was lathering up the guy's cheeks, he accidentally poked the guy in the nostril and got some shaving cream in there and wiped that off and then poked some in between his lips and got some on his... And he finally got all his shaving done, and he was thinking, I've just got to ask my question. And so he got to the point where he was ready to give the guy a shave. Now, in those days, they had this big razor. So he reached behind here to pull the guy's neck up like this to start shaving under here with the razor. And as he did, he was thinking, I need to ask the question. And he pulled the razor in front of the guy's face like this, and he blurted out, are you prepared to die? The guy leaped out of the chair, went flying out the door with his drape on, shaving cream coming all over the place. And, you know, that's not how to start a spiritual conversation. We can do better than that. As Lance mentioned, we are doing this series called Sowing Seeds and Growing Gardens. And the idea, it comes from the metaphor Jesus talked about sowing the seeds of God's word into the lives of people. And that when we do, there are four different kinds of responses generally that he mentions there. Sometimes hard soil, sometimes rocky soil, sometimes path, and sometimes good soil. And so what's intriguing to me about this is that it's generally difficult for all of us as Christians to enter into this. And so what are sort of that first steps that we can do that kind of get us at least thinking along this line and moving? And we start over here with our first banner, which is care. We talked about the parable of the four soils. And sometimes in the lives of some people, they just don't want to hear anything about the gospel. Well, what can help break up that ground? Sometimes care can help break up hard ground. And then we talked about sowing seeds. And the idea there from sowing is we use words. And we don't have to do soil testing with people. We just sow the seed where we can, broadcasting the seed, as it was said. And here the key word is conversations. We use words. We are not shoving truth down people's throats. That is not what it means to share the gospel. And we talked about the pair of the woman at the well in John chapter 4 and how Jesus engaged in conversation. And he asked questions. And he gave some intriguing things for her to think about. And along the course of that conversation, she ended up coming to faith. The third thing we looked at was kindness. And we looked at the parable of the Good Samaritan. And particularly that parable, kindness is undeserved kindness. It's unexpected kindness from the Samaritan to the two Jewish folks who knew what to do, and they were superior, and they didn't need to do this gospel thing, and yet even just a Samaritan expressing kindness made a difference. Last week we looked at friends, and the idea here is from John 15 is something along this line that Jesus calls us his friends. That's a game changer in how we see ourselves as we walk through this life, our identity. And as we relate to those who are not yet Christians, in essence, we're giving them a taste of what it's like to be a friend of God and to have God as a friend. And Jesus encourages us to help to take give them a taste also of what this is like by helping for them to meet some of our Christian friends and kind of the relationships excuse me, that are possible through knowing God. Today we look at serving. Matthew 20, 26 says, "It shall not," Jesus said, "it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be your slave." And here he gives something that's sort of completely antithetical to our current culture. In our current culture, the pyramid of success looks like this. And the more famous you are, and the more of a celebrity you are, and the greater the professional athlete you are, or the greater the actor you are, or the greater the CEO you are, then the higher up the pinnacle you go of perceived importance. And Jesus says, that is exactly how it doesn't happen. And if you think about it, so many times we hear these great stories in the news and the media about the life of the celebrity. But behind the scenes, so oftentimes, those who are the most famous, the most well-known, have a horrendous personal life that nobody knows about. Jesus says one of the problems is that the pyramid is completely upside down. Is that the more that we serve, the more important there's a sense of who we are and our value. And Jesus says, if you want to be great, you be a servant. If you want to be first, you become a slave. And then he gives his own example. Even as the Son of Man, speaking of himself, did not come to be served, but to serve, which is astounding. God in the flesh, and what he deserved was worship. And instead of worship, what he looks for is the towel to serve and to wash feet. And he says, and to give his life as a ransom for many, to lay down his life for other people. It is the complete opposite of the pyramid of importance in our culture. Paul has the same idea, 2 Corinthians 4:5. What we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servant. That's how he saw himself. My job is a servant. A servant. It's not just that he served, but that's how he saw himself, his identity as a servant. Now, one of the things that's always interesting about being a servant, everybody likes the idea of being a servant until you are treated like one by somebody. About a month or two ago, there was a newscaster, I think on MSNBC, named Lawrence O'Donnell, who was doing his broadcast, and a video camera continued to roll between the pieces when they went to commercial break. And this thing went viral. He heard something in his voice, in his earpiece, of some people talking. And while they were supposedly at break, he was just excoriating somebody in there to tell those folks to shut up. And it continued to go on between the little segments. And he was throwing out during the time they went to commercial break, F-bombs and all kinds of things I am not allowed to share. He was livid. And one of the impressions you got as you watch this is that here he, Lawrence O'Donnell, the pinnacle, the top of this pyramid, could not understand how all these little minions at the bottom of the pyramid could not fix this problem. It's one thing to talk about being a servant. It's another thing when we're treated like a servant. Jesus talked about this in Luke chapter 17, verse 7. Now, it's hard for us to imagine what he's going to say here because we really don't have a servant culture like they did 2,000 years ago. As close as we get here is probably, in our modern day, is probably employer-employee, or if you have somebody that comes to, that you're paying to come clean the house, and there's a list of things they're supposed to do, and you get they get about halfway through the list, what happens next? That's about as close as we could get to what he's going to say here. But he asks a series of rhetorical questions. He says, will any one of you, meaning you wouldn't do this, of course nobody would do this, will any one of you who has a servant plowing or keeping sheep say to him when he comes in from the field, come at once and sit down at table and eat and drink? And the rhetorical question is, nobody would do that because there's still more things on the list for the servant to do. Does he not rather say to him, prepare supper for me, gird yourself, and serve me till I eat and drink, and afterward you shall eat and drink? And again, the question is asked in a rhetorical style. Of course, that's just the next thing on the person's list. You're just giving them the next item. And then he says, does he thank the servant because he did what was required? Yeah, of course, it's a good thing to thank people when they serve. Whether employee, doesn't matter. That's a good thing to do. But the point he's making in verse 9 is that the servant doesn't expect thank you. The servant is rather focused on his or her duty. And then he says to us, verse 10, so you also, when you have done all that is your duty, say, we are only servants. We have only done what was our duty. In other words, it's not enough just to serve, but our identity as servants. When I think about this, I often think about people that go to the, come in, watch, or come in, big political people or CEO type people, and they do, they're doing some big conference, and they fly into LAX on a private jet, and they're taken by limo to the Biltmore Hotel, and they go to the dressing room, and if something is out of sorts at the restaurant or at the stage or the microphone, they get all bent out of shape. This is the upside down pyramid that's supposed to happen, but these folks are looking for the stage or the microphone or the place to display something about them, and the servant thinks instead of about when he walks in somewhere, thinks about something very different. A servant walks in, and his thought is, does something need to be done here? Does the kitchen floor need to be mopped? Does the front porch need to be blown off with a leaf blower? Do we need to run a vacuum in here or in room 100? The servant thinks about the janitor closet or what needs to be done. And isn't just kind of hanging around waiting for just the important things to do. That's the life of a servant. That's how a servant sees himself. The cost of serving, John 12:24. Truly I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. And again, Jesus uses this analogy from agriculture that if you have seeds, and no matter how good those seeds are, they are not going to germinate unless they die. They're buried in the soil. But if they are, with the right moisture and the right soil, those seeds will germinate and they will grow and you will have a harvest of flowers or fruit. In Galatians 6:9, Paul has an interesting verse here. If you have tried to serve, there are times in life of everyone who tries to serve where you think, does this really do any good? Does it really make any difference? You look around and you think, man, I keep doing this again and again and again. Does anybody notice anything really happening? Can God really use this? And Paul talks about this in Galatians 6, 9, and 10. He says, do not be weary. Let us not grow weary in doing good. For in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. So then, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. So he's saying, of course, I think he inferred that, of course, there are going to be times when we do get weary in well-doing. We do get weary in serving. Is it really worth it? He says, it will be. Endure. Keep going. And I think about Jesus saying, even if you give a cup of cold water on a hot day to somebody, that gets recorded in the heavenly ledger. There will be reward for those kinds of things. When I think about Paul writing these verses in Galatians 6, and at some point being tempted just to give up and throw in the towel on serving, just two chapters earlier, in chapter 4, verse 11, he says to the Galatians, I'm afraid I've labored over you in vain. All the work and coming there and trying to get the church started, and he's tempted to wonder if it really was it really worth it. And then two chapters later, he writes these verses. In Titus 3, let our people also apply themselves to good deeds to meet pressing needs, that they may not be unfruitful. A serving fits in exactly with the whole motif of bearing fruit in the lives of people. I'd like to use the rest of our time to do a case study, and this is from the Apostle Paul. On his second missionary journey, he went to start a church in Thessalonica, a big city in what is now modern-day Greece. And he, a little bit later, he sends back a letter to them to answer some of the questions they have and to give them some good instruction. And he reminisces here in chapter 2 about how he had been with them, which many of them would remember. You yourselves know, brethren, that our visit to you was not in vain. Verse 2. But though we had already suffered and been shamefully treated at Philippi, as you know, we had courage in our God to declare to you the gospel of God in the face of great opposition. Now here he reminds them of what had happened just before he came to Thessalonica. He had been in a city called Philippi. He had gone there to share the gospel, and he shared the gospel with a woman named Lydia, and Lydia became a Christian, and then he shared the gospel with a woman who was demon-possessed, and two men were using her as a way of making money, and she came to faith in Christ. The demon left. Suddenly she was rational and sane again and whole, and these two men were mad because they lost their income, and they worked up a riot of people. And they got the authorities involved, and they arrested Paul and Silas, and then they had them whipped. In Philippi. Somebody tore their clothes down to their waist. It took something much more brutal than this and began to lay into their backs. Probably the 40 lashes less one. And then when that was done, they were taken to prison, and Luke records that they were put in the inner part of the prison, probably the dungeon part, and then they were put in stocks where their hands and their feet were immobile. Now, if you visited them that night, what you would have heard in the prison about midnight was these two men were singing and praising God, which was quite provided quite a bit of consternation for some of the other prisoners there. Why in the world would these men be singing and praising God? Philippian jailer came to Christ, his whole family, and the household that lived there, all of them came to Christ. The next day, the authorities found out that Paul and Silas were Roman citizens, and they thought, we were in hot water, and they came to release Paul and Silas, and some of the other Christian brothers there in Philippi said, we probably need to get these two guys out of town quick before something happens to them. And so, from Philippi, Paul and Silas traveled about 100 miles to Thessalonica to start this church. Now, when they roll into Thessalonica, it's maybe 5 days since they'd been whipped. Now, when I am going through some kind of injury, I'm kind of a baby when it comes to this. Paul and Silas did not have Excedrin PM. They couldn't go to get a prescription for pain meds. And what I imagined was that these men, as they traveled over the roads for the next 5 days in their robes, with all of these whip marks on their back, that it takes a while for those kinds of things, especially if they're deep, to heal. And every time they would sit down, that robe would sort of attach itself to some of those marks. And when they would get up, it would sort of stretch and pull. And it's just not that easy to heal when scabs keep coming apart. And by the time they got there, maybe 5 days, 6, 7 days later, I imagine these two guys were still in a lot of pain and still healing. He reminds the Thessalonians about this. And then he goes into, once he's there, and there are three words as we look through here I want you to think about. Three sort of categories he keeps describing. When I came there, Paul and Silas, you'll hear commitment in these words, their character, and care for the people. Commitment, character, and care. If Paul had three banners that he could put up in that church in Thessalonica, that's what he would put up. Commitment, character, and care. Let's look at what he says. Verse 3, our appeal does not spring from error or uncleanness, nor is it made with guile. But just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not to please men, but to please God who tests our hearts. Here, what you mostly hear is commitment and character. Verse 5, we never used either words of flattery, as you know, or a cloak for greed, as God is witness. In other words, we weren't in this for the fame, and we were not in this for the fortune, which is quite an understatement. Verse 6, nor did we seek glory from men, whether from you or from others, though we might have made demands as apostles of Christ. They were involved in these people's lives and trying to give them direction to move in the right direction. Now, most of what you hear in verses 2 through 7 is commitment and character. The last five verses, what I hear the most is care. His care for the people. But we were gentle among you, like a nurse taking care of her children. Now, if you know something about the Apostle Paul, Paul's a type A driver, get the job done. That's sort of how the Christian world has thought about Paul. That is his strength. But you don't normally hear Paul, the tender side of Paul, or the people side of Paul. But as he reminisces in these 10 verses, half of these verses have to do with the people side, the care side. And the image he first uses is that of a nurse taking care of her children, taking care of her children. Verse 8, so being affectionately desirous of you, and in the Greek that means strong, the strongest kind of affection. He's putting his heart out there, putting words to it. We were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, because you had become very dear to us. And that little phrase, very dear to us, is the Greek word where the root is agape. It could be translated the beloved, which is one of our five values here, one of our five B's, the beloved. Verse 9, you remember our labor and toil, brethren. We work night and day that we might not burden any of you while we preach to you the gospel of God. Though it would have been appropriate for the folks to take an offering and to help pay some of Paul and Silas's bills, Paul was a tent keeper whenever he needed to be, a tent maker, and that's apparently what he was doing here. You are witnesses, verse 10, and God also, how holy, righteous, and blameless was our behavior to you believers. He goes back to the commitment and character. Commitment, character, care. For you know how like a father, he used the nurse image or the mother image earlier, now he uses the father image with his children, and he tells three things. We exhorted you, encouraged you, and charged you. What do those three words mean? Exhort means to urge. Urge to kind of push. Go ahead. Go ahead. Take a risk. Jump out there. Go for it. Move in that direction. Encourage, we would think of as attaboy. Did something right? Yes. Well done. And charged is a stronger word than exhort. Charge is a legal word in the Greek world. It was sort of like to present a summons, to appear in court. And the idea is here almost the summons to live a life towards God, towards the things of God. Love people, love God. Serve Him, serve people, the idea. Character, commitment, and care. Towards what? To lead a life worthy of God who calls you into His kingdom and glory. Servant. What you hear is he goes into town not as some big celebrity, but as their servant. And as he lives out a life of commitment and character and care towards those people, some of those people become Christians. A church is born in the city of Thessalonica. And a little while later, he's able to write a letter and a second letter back to them, encouraging them in the faith. Now, what Paul did there is something like our five banners so far. You definitely hear care. You definitely hear words. You hear kindness in his voice. He loved them like friends, and he thought of himself as a servant. One of the stories from that I like from World War II is there was a German theologian and pastor named Neiman. What was that guy's name? Martin Niemöller, that's it, Martin Niemöller. And he was a pastor, a Lutheran pastor in the late 20s. Germany was a mess coming out of World War I. Country was in chaos, economic in decline. And they were trying to figure out how do we move our country forward. The communists were knocking at the door. The socialists were knocking at the door. The fascists were knocking at the door. And there was this one fellow, Adolf Hitler, that nobody really knew. Wrote book Mein Kampf, and out of the chaos of this, there was a movement around him that thought would unify Germany once again and bring Germany back to recover from the economics debilitation that had happened and from the loss of so many of the young men and the loss during wartime. But in the 1930s, as people began to hear about what Adolf Hitler was doing, Martin began to realize that he needed to speak out. He began to speak out against Adolf Hitler and against the Nazi regime. And the Nazis warned him, you need to stop speaking out against us or things could get bad. He continued to speak out, and he was warned repeatedly that he could be arrested. Or worse, and he continued to speak out, and finally in 1938, Martin Niemöller was arrested by the SS. He was interrogated. He was told to stop preaching against the Führer, and he refused to do it. But Martin Niemöller was put on a train and taken off to a concentration camp called Sachsenhausen. When he was there, he continued to speak out against the Führer, even in the concentration camp with the guards. And the commandant of the concentration camp went to him and appealed to him to stop doing that or it could get worse. And he refused to do that. And so they put him on a train and took him off to the second worst concentration camp in Europe, Dachau. When he arrived there, he was sure that he was going to die. But he continued to speak out. Against the Führer and against the Nazi regime with the guards. And somehow he survived the war. 1945, liberation of Dachau. While he was at Dachau, one night he had a dream. He was sleeping, middle of the night. And in the dream, he remembers seeing in the dream Adolf Hitler on Judgment Day, standing before Almighty God. And in the dream, Adolf Hitler was making his case for why he should be in heaven. And the excuse he used in the dream was, nobody shared the gospel with me. And right as Niemöller was in the dream listening to this, the next part of the dream, there was a voice towards Martin. And the voice said, were you with Hitler an hour? And said nothing about the gospel? And at that moment, Niemöller woke up from the dream. It was about 2:30 at night in the barracks at Dachau, virtually pitch black. And he realized he had been with Hitler for an hour. And he had said nothing about the gospel. What could have happened? The word that came to his mind as he laid there in his bunk in the darkness at Dachau was the word duty. That he had a duty to share the gospel. And so from then on, even though he realized it might cost him his life, he did that with the guards. Let's pray together. Father, it's easy for us to talk about serving. It's easy to serve when it's convenient, when it's in our skill set, when it's what we like doing. It's easy to serve when we get something out of it. But it's a very different thing to think about ourselves as servants and to think about the duty that we have and the privilege and the opportunity that we have to be a servant of the King, knowing that no matter how great or small our serving may appear to be to us or to others, it does not go unnoticed by you. And that one day that service that we do will have a peace all the way back at caring and sowing, all the way someday we will get a chance to see the fruit of our serving in the imagery of gardens, a harvest in the lives of people. Would you help us to take up the towel and the basin, to see ourselves as servants, to be a people who look for the mop and the broom and the vacuum, so to speak, as we relate to the people around us. To see ourselves as servants of you and of people.
We at Pacific Church of Irvine invite you to join us every Sunday at 9:30. You can also visit our website at pacificchurch.com.